Bandwidth and hosting for Bagel Tech Photo is provided by UK2.net. Web hosting for everyone.
Hello and welcome to Bagel Tech Photo for Friday the 28th of October 2011. We have a slightly different program today. We have no Ewan and we have no Kyle. But we do have the next best thing, which is a Dave and a Carl.
Carl and Kyle. There'll be no confusion.
Well, that's why I was tripping over my own tongue. That's the problem. Okay, now... Chris, we can't find Chris, so it's going to be slightly different, as I say. We're going to touch on a little bit of news, but mainly because Carl being a very good friend of the network, and in fact, I don't think the network would be working very well if it wasn't for him.
No,
and being a very, as he calls himself, a very amateur photographer. I didn't know there was levels of amateurness, but apparently there is. He had put together a few questions to ask me, and luckily we have David Potter up there in Scotland. How are you, David?
I'm good, thanks, Alex.
Nice and warm?
Yeah, it's been a very pleasant day here, a bit chilly, but very nice and crisp and clear, lovely Scottish day.
That's good. But David, we've met before at the Bagel Tech Bash, and you were very knowledgeable on photography, so I'm afraid you're the professional today.
What?
I'm the host.
No!
I'll do what I can to help, of course. What sort of level would you say you are a photographer?
Well, I used to be a club photographer, but over the years that sort of diminished, but I'm starting to get back into it again now. So I'd say I'm a reasonable amateur that knows the basic rules, and I'd like to think I've got a reasonable eye.
Okay, well, that's probably a good start. You're in good company. Carl, how would you describe yourself more honestly than just amateur?
Absolutely amateur. I mean, all I do, I've taken most majority of my photos on the iPhone 4, 4S now, actually. I did go and buy a Nikon D5100 on your recommendation on the show, however. And okay. I absolutely love that camera, I've got to say. I love the video, I love the stills. Produces some really nice pictures. However, I have to cheat.
And cheating is?
Cheating is I'll do the obvious things, like I'll use the golden hour, for example. Or I'll shoot in RAW, because then I know I can go back to the Mac and edit it.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, nothing at all, and unless Ewan was here and we wouldn't mention it. Okay, right, well, we'll start off. There's a couple of interesting items for... news this week, one of which is the new Canon EOS 1DX. Now it's an 18 megapixel camera, but at a show recently, the one of the presidents of Canon said that it functions like a 21 megapixel purely on the fact that he says the quality of the 18 megapixels is far better than the quality of their old 18 megapixel cameras. What I'm basically asking is, do you think this is the way things are going to go? Do you think us on this panel are going to get what we want, which is not so many numbers but so much more quality? Do you think Canon are setting the benchmark, or do you think other people are just going to start carrying on rather pushing the numbers and you know, just seeing how far they can push it?
I think it's an interesting tack they're taking. When I read this, I thought, by heck, they must be Bagel Tech listeners, because it's, as you say, it's what we've been bashing on about for ages. Never mind the numbers, give us the quality. And, you know, they're saying it's 21% bigger pixels on the sensor, which is exactly what you and Ewan and everybody else has been asking for. But what they've done, what to me, is they've tried to get the best of both worlds out of their marketing material by comparing it to a high megapixel rating. So they're pushing the numbers, but keeping the quality up. At least they haven't gone down the Fuji route of trying to get the numbers up by interpolating through software. They've actually done it with a better quality sensor.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. I mean, Fuji have, since their very onset of digital cameras, they've always interpolated to make bigger numbers, but the quality of the images has never really stood up. They're fine if you use them as what they really are, rather than if you use them as what they claim that they can cope with. Do you have any opinion, Carl?
I'm just wondering, what market is this camera aimed at? Is this like top of the range?
Well, it's top of the range DSLR, and I'd say that you've got sort of two different top of the range markets in digital cameras. One of which is, you know, the studio camera, which is medium format, sort of 20 grand onward sort of cameras. And the other part of the market is DSLR, which is, you need to carry around, you need to be able to, rapid shooting. I mean, one of the things that's quite amazing with this camera is it 12 to 14 frames a second?
Yeah.
Such high quality. I did look at, it was a video on YouTube, I think it was, and it was just the burst rate of this camera, and it sounded like a machine gun going off. And if you think about what the data throughput on that is, it's quite incredible. But, so Carl, yes, it's the top of the range, but it's the top of the range of the DSLR as opposed to the medium format.
Okay.
And it is a DX as well, rather than a full frame. So it's sort of not quite in the top pro company, is it, Alex?
Well, I think this is a full frame, isn't it, this camera?
It says DX in the title.
It says DX in its code name, which I thought meant it had a smaller...
Well, DX is actually what Nikon used rather than Canon.
Yeah. Ah, right, that's confusing.
Yes, it's funny enough, there was a point, I think you and Reddit out on last week's show, where people were getting really upset about other people using X for this and D for that and all the rest of it. You've actually reiterated what the person said, so maybe the person did have a point. Okay, well...
Do we know what cost of this will be?
It will be around the $7,000 mark.
Oof.
So, we'll have three of them next week. Okay, now, the next topic, quite interesting. There's a Google scientist, and he's invented something which he claims is a light-efficient photography. Now, the point of this, actually, is he says that you can take photographs with wider apertures, so, speed won't necessarily be so much of a problem. You'll be able to hit moving targets without them getting too blurry. And what he's saying is he can use a bit of software he's developed to put all these images together and form a sharper image with a deeper depth of field using multiples of, blurrier and less depth of field images. I personally like the idea of this because it means cameras that I've given a hard time lately, like iPhone and various things like that, you should be able to cobble a few of them together if you've taken a similar enough shot and produce something quite remarkable. Do you think there's a market for this sort of thing?
Well, I was looking at this. I'm sure there is, but what I couldn't get my head around is whether they were talking about software that sits within the camera and it requires the camera to take a burst of pictures. And if it does require the camera to take a burst of pictures, just how long is it going to take the camera to adjust to different focus settings with that smaller depth of field and capture those images so they can be processed? I was wondering about the physical amount of time it's going to take to take those pictures, that series, that burst of pictures.
Yeah, I mean, the way I sort of understood it, it's something that you should be able to do retrospectively. So if you had three or four, a burst of photographs, I think it will do... Photoshop can do a similar thing with removing people out of pictures. And what you can do, you can shoot off four or five pictures. As long as the majority of the image stays the same, it can then... what it basically does, it takes the information of everything that hasn't changed and it builds you up a new image of that. My understanding is this is working in quite a similar way. It will only take parts of the image that are the same. So you should be able to go backwards and use images that you've already shot. I mean, do you think people will be shooting for this type of photography in the same way some people shoot for Photoshop? Do you think people will be shooting for this corrective measure?
If this is Google software, perhaps... If they could put this into their Android handsets, for example, I don't know if that's capable of that. And then if you do, like a lot of people shoot when they're out at restaurants and in pubs, and the lighting's normally pretty poor. So if you can get really good cameras, pictures from your little handset using this software.
I think you've hit on something there, Carl, because one of the things they mention in the abstract of the scientific paper that they've issued is they talk about both variable focal lenses, but also discrete integer focal lenses as well, or lenses with discrete apertures. So that would absolutely map in with the smartphone market.
Yeah, but I mean, you also, I mean, it's something that did occur to me at the time, was possibly if you, you can shoot, if you like, on video. If you shot video, you know, it doesn't have to be an amazingly high quality, but if you could shoot on video and then pull some of the images off of that, if you shot at even 10 frames per second, the chances are, you, using this technology, you should be able to recover some quite good sharpened images with better depths of field. So is that something that we could pull off of video in the future?
Could be. The only thing I think I have to remember is that, again, the way I read it, is you have to change your focal point through the series of pictures you've got so that there are various pictures with different focal points with a smaller depth of field. So you can add those sharp focal points together to get your continuous bigger depth of field.
Right. So, in other words, it is something that you have to choose to shoot for.
Yes. But they, well, as you say, if you were doing a Vizio and you were zooming and you were focusing in on something, then potentially you could get a series of pictures from that without too much trouble.
Oh, good. But again, like you say, if you actually had this theoretically designed into a camera for a burst mode, which had its own version of maybe taking different focal points within the same burst mode, you could, you know, alleviate the need to go down to, or go up to sort of F30 for sharpness or something. So, yeah, it's one for the future. And, I mean, if the technology works, can you imagine being able to shoot sports photography without having to spend 10 grand on a camera and a lens?
Mm-hmm. That would be nice.
Well,
it's one for the future. I'm sure Canon and Nikon will end up hating Google as much as everyone else does at the moment.
But then Apple can just copy it as well.
Yeah, as long as you don't have to swipe to open the camera, let everyone be happy.
Cameras with PayPal interface. Now, that's what you need.
Yes, exactly. Okay, now, earlier on this week, I discussed with Carl, I like the word amateur photographer. It sounds more like gentleman photographer to me. And he was saying, you know, he doesn't know very much, but he'd like to take this opportunity to ask what I think are very sensible questions, but Carl's... He didn't necessarily call them sensible. I think the word stupid or idiotic came into it, which I don't agree with at all.
No.
But, Carl, do you have any of these questions you sort of plan to ask?
Absolutely. I mean, I keep hearing questions or statements about the rule of thirds when you're shooting landscapes and stuff like that. I was just wondering if you can explain that a little more, what they mean.
Yeah, okay. I don't know if Dave, you want to do it, but...
I'll give it a try, see where we get. So, I mean, the rule of thirds is pretty much what it says it is. If you consider your frame divided up into thirds, both horizontally and vertically, so two lines vertical, two lines horizontal, and then you put the subject focal point or the focus that you want people to make of your subject on one of those thirds, then that gives you a decent composition. It doesn't matter whether it's a left third, the right third, the top third. The lower third gets a bit trickier, but generally it doesn't matter. Now, people also talk about the golden third, which is where you align the focus of your subject on both the vertical and the horizontal third. So it's the intersection of the two. And that gives you a good positioning, composition-wise, for your picture. If you take that a bit further, if you've got something that gives you an L shape into your picture that follows the thirds through, then that again gives you a very good composition to follow through. Seem reasonable, Alex?
Yeah, it's a perfect answer. I mean, the way you need to think about it is a noughts and crosses board.
Hmm.
And then you basically want to stick, if you can, at one of the junctions, one of the interchanges within that grid. I mean, it's a rule, but it's a rule that, funnily enough, if you break it and you break it well, you make a far more interesting photo. But it's one of those, I don't know what the percentage of breaking that rule you're going to get away with it. It's quite low. But don't necessarily stick to it because of that is the only way to take a photograph. It's not the only way. but it's a good place to start. It's like anything, you know, you learn your basic. If you learn this rule and you stick to it for a little while, then you might be able to think, you know what, I can tweak this a little bit, I can tweak that. It's a guide to get you going, but the very, very best photographers, they look at that, they ignore it, and then they do something spectacular. But it's a very good place to start. So don't, you know, yes, it is a rule, but it's not something you really, really need to worry about. What you really need to worry about, I personally think, with a lot of people don't think about with photographs now, and it's something that I go back to, is decide what the photograph means to you, or decide what you want the photograph to say, and then use that, you know, if you like, that emotional part of your decision making to then frame the picture. And if you can frame that emotional picture within using some of these rules that make the composition easier for the viewer, then that's great. But I would actually say start with the emotional content of a picture and then add the rules on top of it, perhaps.
Okay. Actually, emotional content of a picture, that leads into my next question. When taking a portrait, like, I always try and make the face fill the frame, but to do that, I normally have to get a little bit closer than I feel comfortable in getting. I was just wondering if you've got any tips on taking portraits.
Okay. David, do you want to do that? Just...
I'm not really a big portrait person, but there's, I mean, you mentioned before using the thirds rule for landscapes, but there's absolutely no reason not to use that for portraits as well. Ewan tweeted out a lovely picture of his little girl a couple of days ago, and that was very much composed on the thirds. It was great. The other thing on portraits is, getting close by all means, but it doesn't have to be close. Again, the picture that Ewan tweeted out was another great example of that. The one thing about portraits, I would say, and I think Ewan said this in the past, is when you focus, make sure you focus on the eyes. Check your autofocus. If your autofocus is not focusing on the pupils of the eyes, then it won't look as good. So if it needs a bit of manual adjustment on the focus, just to be... have the eyes pinned sharp, you'll get a better portrait, particularly if you're going in close, because your depth of field will be a lot smaller.
Yeah, I mean, that's possibly the main problem with going in close, is the fact that your depth of field could be so shallow that, you know, you can actually lose a lot of the definition that you can get with portraiture. Also, you know, when you're slightly further away, you get slightly better and more subtle lighting. If you go straight into somebody... you can have, you know, issues with the lighting, be a bit harsh, the shadows across the nose and things like that. But in general, I mean, I would say with portraiture, one of also the problems people do have with it is a lot of people have got this idea of the shape of a print in their head, and they shoot for the shape of the print or the shape of the camera. When you've got a camera which has got, I don't know, 10 megapixels is more than enough to do this portraiture-wise, be a little bit wider and then use an inventive crop. Don't necessarily crop for the normal print size. Crop for what makes the picture more interesting. Portraits work so much better when they're not the standard frame, the standard size print. Square portraiture works really, really well. So I wouldn't necessarily get too close. You've got enough, especially, I mean, I know you've got a D5100.
Yep.
Now, that's got more than enough megapixels to be able to do some intelligent cropping afterwards. So... sit back a little bit, you'll get slightly better depth of field. You'll also probably get a bit sharper. Because, you know, unless you've got a very good lens, getting a little bit too close, it's never going to be as sharp as if you're the proper distance away. And use a crop.
Okay.
Don't necessarily get into somebody's face. Use a crop. And, I mean, you're a big fella, you can probably get away with getting into somebody's face. But for us mere mortals, we tend to sit back and, you know, a bit worried about people's responses. But,
Okay. My next question is, a friend's got a wedding coming up soon, and they've invariably asked the question, because they see the big camera, can I do some of the pictures? And I said, well, obviously, have a pro, but I have no problems with, like, just walking around taking candid shots and stuff like that. Is there any tips you can suggest for wedding photography?
Well, the one thing I would say is, if there's a pro, let him worry about the set-up shots. You know, because of it's not so much he gets paid for that and he'll be brilliant, but I personally hated doing them. And so if someone set themselves up as a photographer to do a wedding, let them do that wedding. you know the people, you know the personalities, I hope. And so you'll be able to, you'll know who's the cheaty bugger. You'll know who's in love with who. You'll again, it goes back to that emotional content. You take the candid pictures, but have the thought of who you, that person is that you're photographing, and try and frame the picture to say what you think of that person. Because invariably, your response will be the same as the bride and groom's to the person you're photographing. So keep that in mind and keep about, you know, if you know you've got some guy that's a bit of a chatting up the girls or whatever, make sure you get the picture of him chatting up the girls. Make sure you get the personality of the people that you know into your pictures.
Okay.
Yeah, but, I think I'd reiterate what Alex was saying. You're going to be at the wedding at a time when that professional photographer's not going to be there. And most importantly, you're almost certainly going to be there towards the end of the evening when people have had a few drinks, they've lost their inhibitions, they're a bit more relaxed and a bit less conscious, a bit self-conscious about what they're doing in front of the camera. Perfect time to take the candids. Now, that's the time to get them, rather than worrying about, you know, when the pro's there and he's getting them all set up, you know, family of the bride, family of the groom, all that sort of stuff. Take pictures of the pro. That's the other thing. And the people watching the pro do his work. Mm-hmm. That's always a good shot.
Okay. Mind you, towards the end of the night, I was hoping I'd be drinking as well by then, but...
that's the downside.
I was a little bit worried about they weren't going to be conscious towards the end of the night. But yeah, I don't know what sort of weddings you go to, but it sounds like good fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. But yeah, I mean, I tell you, one of the things that does work is when people are, you know, they're lining up for the bro. I mean, I hated that because you can never get everybody to look in the same direction at the same time. I mean, one of the big bugbears I did have as a pro when I used to do that sort of thing is because you had someone standing on your shoulder using your setup, half the people will be looking at them. So bear that in mind, because of hanging around the back of the photographer when he's taking pictures actually interferes with the people looking in the right direction. And again, not being funny, but you know, you're a big fella. You're going to stand out. You're probably going to dwarf the photographer. So, you know, be conscious of that. But, you know, say to the photographer, you know, once you've got them set up, once you're happy with that shot, do you mind if I step in and just take a few of them? Possibly not. The shots you could take would be the setup shots when they're not taking notice of the photographer.
Mm-hmm.
The ones where they should be looking forward, but auntie is still talking to auntie and uncle's still fighting with cousin, you know? They're quite good. But make sure you've, you know, said to the photographer, you know, I don't want to interrupt people. I don't want to disturb their focus on you, but give me a nod when you can. And so you can just get in there at the end of his setup pictures and just get a few candid ones, because quite often they work really well. And another point, it goes back to your portrait. At that point, do zoom in on people's faces, because there's a lot of distraction going on there, and there's a lot of people, their real smiles at that point.
Yeah.
After you've stood there, I mean, you know, I've been through the wedding myself. After you've stood there for a while, those smiles get incredibly fake. They actually start to hurt after a while. So just before he gets everyone going and everyone's still got that excitement about it, getting not personally close, but zooming close on their faces, because you'll get some really happy expressions. They won't be tired, but they'll still be exhilarated. So that's a good point. But please don't interfere when the photographer's trying to take the setup shots.
Absolutely.
They are so impossible if anyone's standing behind them.
No, okay, fair. Yeah. That's good. Good tips.
I think you did. I think you did the most important thing, by the way, which is to actually say only if there's going to be a pro there as well, because I've done a few where in the past where I've been the only photographer, and Alex is a professional, so you know he's used to being under pressure with that stuff. But the thought that you could take the pictures for a wedding and they're the only pictures of the wedding, and you could do something absolutely awful to them, and they lose all the record of the day, it is mortifying.
Exactly.
And it's, they're not friends if they ask
no,
me to do that.
Well, they certainly wouldn't be friends afterwards if it went wrong.
Well, you know, that is the main reason I don't do it. And look, good luck to those that do it. But I've always done it as this is a favour, right? So if it all goes wrong, it goes wrong. It never has. But I don't want the responsibility. And if someone's paying me, I still don't want the responsibility. You've got to be a tougher man than me to do it. You probably need to be a better photographer as well, but you certainly need to be a tougher man. So, yeah, as long as other people are there, you know, take more than one camera. Make sure that you've got a couple of friends with a point and shoot, because you'll be amazed how many times the point and shoot picks up that moment that's really special. And what you can do, which is always a good way of getting around it, use your pictures, get some people that did point and shoot to send them to you, and put something together as a package. Because of when, you know, you don't need to give them the 500 shots you take.
No.
Put the 20 or 30 together as a package. Use, you know, one of the photo things on the internet. It doesn't have to be Apple. You know, get something printed. They're not very expensive. Get something printed. Make sure you get some other people's pictures in there as well, so it's not just Carl's pictures. And this is a guest's vision of the wedding, and give that as a present. And you'll be, I think you'll be liked forever.
Nice. That's good. Some really good suggestions there. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Okay. We have some, shall we say, listeners' questions. One of them I'm a little bit suspicious of, but we'll come to that at the end. Okay, now, I haven't read these questions, so let's see where we get. And I can't read either, because my glasses are blurry. Right. Question one, it says, "Hi, guys. Thanks to your advice, I recently went from my trusty Panasonic Lumix to a new Nikon 5100. And I have to say, I'm loving it. Thanks, Alex." Okay. Now, there is a lot more of this question, but you didn't write this one, did you, Carl?
No, this wasn't me. Although right. I did write a similar one a few months ago.
Okay. Right, I'm pretty new to DSLRs, but I get the balancing of exposure, capture and aperture, so I can play around a little. But with my old Lumix, I could shoot straight into the sun and not have to worry too much. And I knew the Lumix would balance everything out for me on automatic. However, on the Nikon, I've yet to manage to get a decent picture into sunlight, and I'm in desperate need for some top tips. Thanks, Gary Barton from Derby. I could give you a few top tips. David, have you got any top tips? Go back to the Panasonic.
Well, there's always that. The problem we've got with any shot into the sunlight is there's only so much contrast a sensor can deal with. Our eyes will deal with hell of a lot more contrast than a camera will, whether it's a DSLR sensor, whether it's film. It just can't cope. So what I do is I keep some neutral density filters, graduated neutral density filters in my camera bag, and shooting into the sun might be a little bit too much for them, but certainly for getting rid of that whited out sky when there's a high contrast, they're fantastic for. But yeah, some of the deep neutral density filters might help with them. The other thing is just try and get the effect, but keeping the sun slightly out of the frame might help a little bit as well. You just need to take that contrast down a bit. If you've got the sun directly in frame, then I can't think of a way at the point of shooting where you're going to be able to not get burnout at some part of your picture without some additional help from filtering or whatever. Thoughts, Alex?
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, it's always going to be a filter issue. I mean, one of the things you can do with shooting with RAW is you can always expose for the highlight values, and then you can use, I can't remember what it's called, recovery, or you can use shadow and highlight values in Photoshop to bring back the things that are in shadow. I mean, it's not the perfect solution, but sometimes it is the only solution. The only other thing I do, which I don't do if I'm wearing my real glasses, but if I don't have a filter and I do have sunglasses on, I actually shoot through sunglasses. And the sunglasses not being on my eyes, the sunglasses being in front of the camera. And sunglasses are, to all intents and purposes, a filter.
And this one's cheap thingy.
There you go. You will have to correct afterwards for colour, but it's always an option. I have done it quite a few times, and there's a number of times I haven't corrected for colour because it's made some really, really interesting effects. Use tree dapple as well. That's a really good way of being able to cope with shooting into the sun. You can block out the sun, but, you know, don't do it artificially with your hand or something. But if you do it with a dappled effect through trees or anything, you can set the shot up that way. But, yeah, it is a filter issue, basically. But
just going on what you said there, Alex, there's also, and I cannot remember the name of it for my life, there's a technique where you can actually take multiple shots at different exposures, some for the foreground, some for the some for the sky, and then merge them together to actually get an overall decent exposure. I can't think what the name of it is, but there are some programs that will merge them together.
Yeah, it's like a high dynamic range issue, but you can
do that. That's the one.
Yeah, you can do that without messing up the colours too much, because you can neutralise them before you mix them. But yeah, that's another option. But there are options. Most of them are Photoshop options. But the professional way, if there is such a thing, because you'd try and avoid it if you could, but the professional way would be used to use neutral density filters. I mean, how are you finding the Nikon... I'm sorry, I'm turning around to look at the screen. So how are you finding the Nikon card?
Oh, I love it. I mean, I take it down to London, and although sometimes the light's a bit too harsh, like especially during midday, and all this sun we're getting at the moment, it's just too much sometimes. But as the afternoon goes on and the sun gets lower, it produces some really nice photos. And like I say, I love the video aspect of it as well.
I'm glad you're enjoying it, and I will recommend a Canon one day, but not just yet. Right, okay, question two. Dear, well, it says Kyle, you and Alex and Chris, so I'm going to re-say that. Dear David, Alex and Carl, I recently listened to another podcast. Right, next question. sorry, it says. And they were talking about lenses for landscapes. And to tell the truth, by the end of it, I was more confused than I was when I started. I have shot with a 15mm Canon, there's your problem, lens, which I'm only kidding, which I love, but mostly as it was all I could afford at the time. Is there a lens which is perfect for landscapes? Perhaps you could give me a money, no object answer. And one that I could afford. Love the show. Regards, Mike in Lynx. A perfect lens? No. I would say there's no such thing as a perfect lens. You shoot with Canon, I'm completely limited now. I mean, the only thing I'd say is a 50mm Canon lens, I imagine, because it's just a 50mm lens, I imagine it stops down quite a long way. I imagine it's quite fast. I imagine it's got all the things you could like. A lot of people like to use telephoto or zoom lenses for landscape shots. There really is... The only reason you'd need anything is just so you can frame the picture slightly differently. I would say there's no better or... I mean, you can buy a better lens, e.g. it's just a better lens. But there's no lens I'd say is specifically better for landscapes. People that shoot landscapes will completely and utterly disagree with me. But in the same way as I'd say there's a perfect lens for shooting the painting, and other people would disagree with me. I don't know enough about Canon to be of any real help. I don't know if you do, Dave.
No, never shot with a Canon. Very much a Nikon man, I'm afraid.
Well, it's nothing to be afraid about.
Just can't add anything to this one, I don't think.
No.
Other than what you were saying is perfectly true. I mean, ideally, you'd like a nice, fast lens that stops down well and that gives you a good, sharp picture. But if you're out taking landscapes, you can't necessarily always use your legs to get to the position you want to be in to get that perfect picture, because there might be all sorts of things in the way that's stopping you getting that picture that from the angle that you want it to. And in that case, it's only a telephoto that's going to do the job for you.
Yeah,
so
cool.
Lots of people will say, yeah, something like a 55 used to be the one, because it used to get on an old 35mm cameras, because it gave you something that approached what the eye saw. But no, if you can walk to the perfect position, absolutely great. 50mm is great. But you know, you can't always do that.
I'd suggest actually that more importantly in a good lens would be a good tripod. I would have said if you're going to invest anything to improve your landscapes, I'd invest in a tripod. Carl, do you have any? I mean, I'm not expecting you to name a lens, but
this is good, because whenever I shoot landscapes, they always come out sort of flat, if you see what I mean.
That's because you're so tall and you're looking down on them.
No, I mean, I can't figure out a way to get them to sort of pop off the page, so to speak, or the screen. They always just look bland and flat. I mean, it could be just me badly composing the shot, I guess.
The funny things with a landscape, you know, you're talking about an outdoor area which can be as vast as... Oh, it could be, you know, hundreds of miles wide if you take it in the savannah or something. It's the light that makes the picture. It's not, you know, you point the camera in the right direction and you get the focus to the point where you want, and that's more or less all you can do. It's the light that's going to pop it up. I mean, if you're finding that you've got slightly flat, you need, if you haven't got natural contrast, you need to add contrast. A nice way of doing it is making it a contrasty black and white photo.
Mm-hmm.
And then things that look bland and dead will start to pop out of the page. But there's not a lot you can do. There's not enough lights in the world to recreate a landscape if the lighting is making the picture look flat and dull.
You talked earlier on, Carl, about the golden hour. And one of the points about the golden hour is it makes the lighting very soft. And what that does is take some of the contrast out of the picture. This time of the year, when the sun's nice and low, it can give a sideways element to the light that's illuminating a landscape, and you can get some really good contrast because of the angle of the light rather than the quality of the light.
Yeah, and also, you know, go somewhere else in the world.
Okay, I can try those things. Maybe not the last one just yet, but I'm trying to.
Okay, right, question three. Hey guys, my wife loves to make cards, and she wants to make use of some pictures of the flowers in her garden in the spring. The problem is that she never takes a picture that satisfies her. I have to agree, but I don't tell her I said that. I'm not going to give your name away then. Like a good husband and wife partnership, I try and help. We end up arguing. Do you have an answer that I could play to her to help her take better pictures of flowers? Love the show and happy to rub it in that I'm getting all the good light. Oh, I see, he's in Perth. Right, okay.
I take it that's not Perth. Scotland then.
You get good light in Scotland for about three or four hours a year.
Yeah.
Okay, so flower photography. Again, this is the opposite to what I said before. To get a really nice picture of a flower, you need a good macro lens. Something that can really get in, something that really, you know, money does help here because you want something f1.4, 1.8, something in there, and get really tight in. And obscure angles work really well with flowers. Shoot up at a flower. One of the things about shooting flowers, don't necessarily shoot the flower the way we see it when we walk past it, because it's a background image there. Shoot a flower from an obtuse angle. Shoot up into the flower. Shoot up to the flower with a little bit of maybe blue on. Well, you're in Perth, so you probably do get blue skies occasionally. A little bit of blue sky possibly breaking between the open petals at the top. Flower photography, it's actually a specialist, you know, people specialise in shooting flowers. And most of them actually do cut them, take them inside, build black rigs and various things and play games with them. But it's the angle you shoot and the crop that makes the picture with a flower. Not just, if you shoot a bunch of flowers, you shoot a hedgerow, you shoot anything like that, there's so much information in there that the picture can't stand out. There's nothing that, it's a load of green, it's a load of red, it's a load of, it's just a mixture of colour. You really want to get in, you want to get tight, and you flower in an obscure place. A lovely flower growing out of a rocky bed. Something like that. You've got the detail of the flower against the sparseness of the background. Like I say, it's a specialist thing, but, you know, getting tight with a good lens, and it's something you really need to frame the picture in your mind's eye, but make it different. Don't shoot the flower the way you normally see it when you walk past. Anyone else?
Absolutely. I mean, when I first got that camera that you suggested, the Nikon, the first thing I did is went in the garden and started taking macro shots of flowers, because I knew that it was summer to begin with. Mind you, it's still summer now, it feels like. And flowers were out, everything was full colour, the sun was shining, and those pictures just rocked. That's what, in my humble opinion.
not so humble. I've seen some of them, they're excellent.
Okay, thank you very much. So that's all I can suggest, getting close, as Alex says, getting close, get a nice depth of field thing going so the actual flower pops as well, and get some nice sun, and from an unusual angle.
Yeah. Depth of field's a good one, yeah. Have a small depth of field, isolate the, you know, if you're getting in close to an individual flower, use a small depth of field to isolate the flower against its background. Always helps.
Yeah. Okay, I think we've done quite well with that one. Okay, then last question. Now, I actually am a little bit worried about
this.
I think whoever wrote this is a little bit lacking in any sort of professionalism or expertise, but I'll read it anyway. I hope he doesn't get offended, whoever this person is. Right, so it says, hey, Kyle, Alex, Chris and David. Now, it's funny how he knew we were here. Okay, but anyway, we'll go past that. Keep up the good work on the shows. I'm getting all my friends to listen and trying to get them to join in. Okay, that's nice. Right, I recently stayed in a caravan and left my camera out of the bag overnight. When I woke up, there was a lot of condensation on the outside and unfortunately on the inside as well. The autofocus didn't work very well and all that day, and some of the shots had misting in corner.
In one corner.
Is that what it says? In one corner, as the moisture was still inside the camera. Should I consider a claim on my insurance, or do you think this won't be covered? I currently have Canon 1DS Mark II, and could to put the money towards a new Canon 1DX when it finally comes out. Is that a good move for me? Regards some fella called Ewan, and he's in Porthmadoc in North Wales. I don't know where Ewan is at the moment. Anyway, so if you knew someone stupid enough to do that, what would you recommend? Someone bigger than me, answer, please.
I don't know. If you're going to leave your cameras lying around all night long in cold conditions, I'm not sure you should have a camera in the first place, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, in all seriousness, it's something I used to get problems with. If occasionally I used to leave, say, lenses in a car overnight, if you were going into a hotel or something, you'd take a lot of the stuff in, but you'd leave some because basically you were too lazy to go and get them. And the change in temperature tended to be what misted up my my lenses. The only trouble you will have is by the time you try and make a claim, it would have dried out. I mean, I personally would recommend you do get rid of the Canon 1DS Mark II, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend getting another Canon. That 1DX is a lovely camera. I would have a look at your insurance claim, and if that fails, then beg and be really, really nice to your wife for a very long time. I think that might be the answer. David, you got a suggestion?
Well, if the moisture's got into the autofocus and it's done a real job on the lens and it's done a whole bunch of lenses, then it could well be that the investment he's got in lenses isn't really worth that very much anymore, and he can actually move to a decent camera like a Nikon.
Yeah, that is another theory, actually. It never occurred to me that, you know, this may be the opportunity to actually, to sort of reinvent your life, you know, make
upgrade.
It better. Upgrade your entire life by getting rid of a Canon. No, that's a terrible thing.
Can't you fix it the same way you fix a phone when you drop it in the water, to stick it in a sealable bag with loads of rice?
You could try that. And when that doesn't work, you could claim on the insurance having rice stuck inside your camera. But yeah, I would say it's a very, very silly thing to have done. But I would also say that, in all seriousness, it's a nice camera. If you are ever concerned that your camera has a problem, don't play with it yourself. Take it to, I say, reputable. There's so few people around, they're all actually reputable, because they're the only ones that have managed to survive. But take it to a good camera shop. I mean, I use a specialist place in South London, and just get them to give everything a really good clean. A lot of this moisture will dissipate and disappear anyway. I'm actually quite surprised that a Canon, with all the seals that Canon do have, would gain any problems. But I would get it a good clean and a good service. And if you have got any insurance problems, they'd probably be the people you'd need to get them to write to your insurance company anyway. But I hope your camera works soon, and I hope you're having a really nice holiday. And I hope if you don't get a Canon 1DX soon, you get a proper camera. Okay, well, thank you, gentlemen, very much. We have a few announcements to make on the BagelTech Network. Our main announcement is to thank our sponsors, UK2.net, who, without them, we really wouldn't be able to sit here and make fun of Ewan and his Canon camera. Not that Canon is make funnable, but the UK2.net, they provide all the bandwidth for the network. They, whenever we mess up, they're always straight there fixing. Whenever we go over our bandwidth, we go over our amount, they're never a quibble. They just up everything we've got and say, go on, you're doing a good job, get on with it. So we have two codes that if you go to uk2.net, please do it through the BagelTech website, go and have a look at their prices. They're very, very competitive, and as I say, they're a very, very, very good company. I've used them personally myself before I ever came to the network. So that is my recommendation. If you do buy anything from them, we have codes, as I say. We have a BagelTech code. So once you've bought, go to checkout, put in BagelTech, and you will get 15% off your purchase. Alternatively, or as well, if you want to move over your websites, And normally there's a charge for doing this, which is a DNS management charge. But as a BagelTech listener, you will be exempt for that as well. So you not only enter your BagelTech code, you can put in BagelDNS, and they will waive that charge for you also. Can't say fairer than that. For the next couple of days, I think that's all that's left. Also on the website, there is a sponsors and friends link, and it's a UK to win a Nintendo 3DS one-year hosting or a £25 iTunes voucher. Just click on that, go through to their site. You'll see a question where I think the answer might be 2 terabyte or something along that line. Read the article. It's very simple to find the answer. Put in the answer and you'll be entered into this free draw, and you may win something magnificent. And if not, please just have a good look and see what they've got on offer. They help us every step of the way. And thank you for listening. David, where can we get hold of you, seeing as we're going to probably use you weekly because your knowledge has been so great?
Oh, right, at MainPlus UK.
Okay.
Well, Twittery thing.
Well done. And Carl, where can we get you on one of your many, many websites?
No, it's just best probably on Twitter. It's claw0101, C-L-A-W-0101.
And would you mind just explaining why your name is Claw?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so it goes back to, it was a character from my, when I used to do role-playing Dungeons & Dragons when I was a kid, and I've just kept that name all the time. That's why it's Claw. And of course, Claw had gone, so I had to do 01. Claw 01 had gone, so I'd done 0101.
Well, just as well they hadn't got one of them as well. They'd been all right. Okay, and if you're interested, you can get me at BagelTechPhoto. I think that's gmail.com. But alternatively, get me at AlexGFox on Twitter. Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen, for making a very interesting show. I think we may be the lunatics taking over the Cylon soon again, I hope.
Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. You did very well, both of you, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
Bandwidth and hosting for BagelTech Photo is provided by UK2.net. Web hosting for everyone.